Chief Judge Gregory, and may it please the Court.
Mr. Wall, if I can ask you, before you get started, to clarify what you view the scope of the preliminary injunction to be. I have two questions. The district court order enjoins Section 2C of the executive order, which suspended entry. During the district court's discussion of success on the merits, the district court said that suspension of entry, it appeared it said, suspension of entry under 1182 did not conflict with Section 1152's barring discrimination and the issuance of visas for immigrant visas. So here are the two questions. Is it your view that the district court's injunction enjoins the suspension of entry provision as well as the denial of visas, and does it apply to both immigrant and non-immigrant visas?
Your Honor, I think the answer to both of those questions, as I read the order that the district court separately entered, is yes. Now, I think the reasoning of the court's opinion would indicate that this injunction against suspension of entry can't stand. At most, it would justify an injunction that would force us to give immigrant visas, not non-immigrant visas, and it wouldn't get you anything at entry. That seems to me the reasoning of the district court's opinion, but as I read the district court's order and the end of its opinion, it said, I am enjoining 2C everywhere it operates in the United States and across the United States' borders and at every point of entry, not consulates, not issuance of visas. It said Section 2C. That's the way we've taken it. That's the injunction we've been complying with. So
that was based on that was based on a violation of the Establishment Clause, right?
Yes, that was the basis for Judge Schwong's decision.
Not based on the statutory violation, as I understand it.
That's right. I mean, I think his statutory analysis would suggest that he could not have entered this injunction, but I think he did ultimately enter the injunction just on the Establishment Clause claim, and I think that's how he got to suspending entry under 2C.
Do you view them as separate, the issuance and the entry?
So, Judge Nguyen, here's what I'd say. The 1182F gives the president broad authority to suspend the entry of, it says, any class of aliens when he deems it in the national interest. Now, 1152 separately deals with the issuance of visas. The way that the State Department has always read that is to say, when you are suspended for some valid reason under 1182F, we're going to deny you a visa because it doesn't make any sense for you to travel here and then be actually denied entry into the country at the borders. And the reason is not the underlying entry for the 1182F suspension. It's just the fact that you've been validly suspended under 1182F. So what we would say is, no, 1152 is not a limit on 1182. 1182 has always been implemented through the denial of visas. And forcing us to grant visas just so that people could come to the country and then be denied entry, we would say, is a sort of fruitless exercise that the State Department has never engaged in.
But doesn't conflating 1182 and 1052, doesn't it render 1152 superfluous?
I don't think so, Judge Floyd. 1152 applies across the board in circumstances well beyond suspension, where we're just handing out immigrant visas. And what it was designed to do was set aside the set aside the nationality limits that had existed before the amendment. All this does is it says, and I think the D.C. Circuit in Abu Resk said this, is in the narrow context of the president's sweeping power under 1182F, it says, all right, the president has the power to suspend entry. We know that under 1182F. We're not going to read 1152 in that instance to force the government to give out visas that we know it won't have to honor when they show up. We're going to say when you're denied a visa under 1152, it's not to look through and see what the reason was. It's just you've been validly suspended from entering under 1182, and that's got nothing to do with nationality.
Is that reading supported by Section 1201G, or is Section 1201G have serve a different role?
No, I think it is supported by 1201G, and we pointed this out in our opening brief, because what 1201G says is a visa doesn't actually entitle you to enter. It's a travel document that says you can come to the United States, but we still can take a look at the border and see whether we're going to admit you, and a customs official who has a reason not to let you in can deny you entry. So I think 1201 supports the view that if the suspension is valid as a statutory matter under 1182F, we shouldn't read 1152 to force the government to give you a visa. But again, even if you bought that distinction which Judge Shuang drew, it would justify a very different injunction from this one. It would just be an injunction that says for the 30% or so aliens here who are seeking immigrant visas, which is the only thing 1152 applies to by its terms, we'd be forced to give them visas that we wouldn't have to honor when they showed up at our borders. We would say that's harsh and fruitless, but at most it's the injunction that would get
you. Mr. Wall, in real-world terms, what does this injunction stop you from doing that you could have done otherwise? These folks now just go through the normal process. Does it net them just participation in the process? Does it mean they get on a plane somewhere and can get off the plane at the customs area? Does it allow them in the country? What is the real net gain for somebody under this injunction?
Judge said that's yes. So when you're talking about the six listed countries, so Iran, Sudan, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, what the injunction does is what the president wanted to do was say, I want to reassess vetting procedures for those designated countries, which were designated by Congress in the previous administration.
Got all that, but I mean, right. Net world, what does it mean?
Net world, what it does is it says, look, Mr. President, you can't treat nationals from those countries any differently. If they show up at a consulate and they're otherwise eligible for a visa, you have to give it to them just as you would a national of France or Germany. What you can't do is say, I'm going to suspend your entry unless you qualify for a waiver.
And that's when they get that doing. Visa, what does that entitle them to?
It entitles them to get on a plane and come to the United States, and when they arrive in the United States, unless there is some specific reason, like a national security threat that the customs official detects, they are admitted to the United States. That's the effect.
Well, Mr. Wall, with respect to this reassessment of vetting procedures, it's been more than 90 days since the first order was implemented. Has the government made any efforts effort to engage in that vetting procedure, process?
We have not been able to, Judge Diaz, but not because of the result of the injunction.
Why,
this
busy writing briefs?
So, no, Judge Shedd, because Judge Shuang here only enjoined 2C, but the district judge in the Hawaii case enjoined all of Section 2 and all of Section 6, and Section 2A is the section that directs the departments to conduct a review of the vetting procedures with respect to these countries. We went back to the Hawaii judge and said, look, you can't possibly have meant to enjoin internal governmental procedures to look at vetting for these six nations. And in the face of that motion, the district judge said, yes, I'm standing by my injunction on all of Section 2C. We have complied by that injunction. We have put our pens down. We haven't done any work on it. So the 90-day period, in our view, has not been able to run at all. We haven't been able to do
anything. What
about
the 90-day period in the first executive order?
So, Judge, that's an excellent question, Judge King. When the first order came out, the State Department and Homeland Security did begin to assess the vetting procedures for these designated countries. They didn't finish that review, but they did some work on it.
So you're not going to need the whole 90 days in any event, correct?
Well, I think the problem, Judge Motz, is as soon as the second order came out, there was an injunction before it even took effect, so they put their pencils down. Now, exactly how much time they need to finish, I don't know, but the point is, since March 16th, we have complied with the Hawaii injunction, and we have done nothing to review the vetting procedures for these
That's
nations.
That's like 50 days. After the first executive order, before the second went into effect, is about 50 days. So 50 days of the 9-day period ran. Is that correct?
That's right, Judge King. And
so
we did some work.
You're not doing it because you believe you're forbidden by the order to do it?
We went back to the judge in Hawaii and said, surely you only meant to suspend the entry of nationals under 2C of the listed countries and refugees under Section 6. Surely you couldn't have meant to suspend or to enjoin the operation of other provisions that were not the subject of the briefing and that are internal to the government. And the district court, in the face of that, denied our motion, and we have we've taken the injunction by its terms, deeply disagree with it, but we have scrupulously complied with it.
All right, let me ask you a question going back to the visas, make sure I understand it. If 2C were in effect, an application was made by a person from one of these countries, how would that be handled? How would the request for the visa be handled?
All right. So if you were a Somali national and you came to a consulate and you were seeking a visa, what the consular officer would do is, as with anyone else, he would look and say, do you satisfy the other criteria to get a visa? Because there's lots of other grounds in 1182A that can render you inadmissible. Criminal record, ties to terrorist organizations, and all the rest. If you satisfy all of those, if 2C operated, what the consular officer then would say, okay, are you eligible for a waiver? Because the baseline is you're suspended, but if you have a close family member in the United States or you've done work there or you are going to study there, then you can get a waiver. Under the current system, we're not doing it individualized on a sort of waiver basis. You're treated like everybody else. You satisfy the criteria. You get the visa, even if you're from one of these countries. And I think that's sort of a crucial point. The Congress in the previous administration designated these countries, wasn't done by this administration, on the basis of national security threats. And what the president did when he came into office was say, look, I know the previous administration was satisfied that that was enough for these particular countries, but I'd like an opportunity to reassure myself that we're doing enough with respect to those countries.
You're
so
saying
as opposed
the previous
to just,
administration did what with respect to those six countries?
It took dual nationals and travelers to those countries, so individuals with connections to those countries. It took them out of the visa waiver program. So it said, unlike nationals from other countries, we're not going to allow you
in
to...
In those countries in their entirety?
That's dual nationals and even just visitors to individuals with connections.
Only those six countries?
Just those, well, yes, seven countries including Iraq, but those seven countries, yes. And it said, look, for those, we're taking them out of the visa waiver program. We're going to make them get visas. And this administration said, okay, well, that's well and good, but we are not sure that the procedures by which we're giving them visas are reliable enough because we're not sure those governments are giving us good enough information. We want a 90-day pause subject to the individualized waiver process just while we check the procedures and make sure it's enough. And at bottom, that's a policy judgment for the administration to make. And a number of the arguments that the plaintiffs and the amici are making are, in essence, tackling that policy judgment. They deeply disagree with it, and I understand that. But it's a difference of degree, not kind, from what the previous...
It seems to me that they're not attacking the policy judgment or the merits of the policies so much as they are questioning whether that really is the policy behind this order. Isn't that right? And those are two different things. We, of course, customarily defer to the executive's assessment of national security, but that's different, isn't it, from the question of, for want of a more legal term, whether that's really what's going on here.
It is, but I think it's important to understand the legal standard that the district court should have applied. And I'm assuming now, by the way, that you found that the one individual plaintiff left, John Doe 1, has Article 3 injury and has prudential standing to raise an Establishment Clause claim. But assuming you disagree with us on standing and you go to the merits, what we would say is, under Mandel, the question is it facially legitimate and bona fide? And this court of others have said that is basically rational basis review. And the question you'd ask under rational basis review was it irrational for the president to decide, I want a 90-day pause to take a look at these procedures? And as long as their arguments are framed in that context, was this an irrational judgment? No reasonable government official in the executive branch could have made this judgment. We have no objection to them. But most of them, they're framing under a far more stringent standard.
How did bona fide get collapsed into rational basis? It seems to me that the Mandel formulation talks about what is the facial rationale,
right.
And then also, is it bona fide? And those are two different things, right?
Oh, they are. And I think there'd be an interesting debate to have about what the bona fide means, except for what Mandel said and what it did. Because after it said facially...
Was there any evidence in Mandel? Was there a public statement, an official statement on the record that called into question the purported rationale for the decision in Mandel?
Judge Harris, just two quick things on that. One, the court, after it said facially legitimate and bona fide, said courts will not look behind as long as it's facially legitimate and bona fide. So what the court meant by bona fide had to be bears a rational relationship to the conduct, not inquiry into subjective motivations. But yes, there was. Justice Marshall in dissent said, if the court will take, quote, just the briefest peek, he said, you'll all see that the Attorney General didn't deny Mandel a visa because he had failed to comply with his visa on a previous visit. He denied it because he was a communist, and he wanted to come to this country and talk about communism and Marxism. And Justice Marshall said the evidence is there if the court will just look at it. And the court said no. When the executive puts forward a reason that is on its face legitimate and that bears a relationship to what it did, we're not going to go down the road of inquiring into subjective motivations.
What
and that's
the record
why
supports the legitimacy of this on its face?
So the order lays out the conditions in these six nations. Now, the original order did not, but the president went back and, in redrafting the order in response to court's concerns, went through these six listed countries nation by nation in Section 1 and said, here is why I think that based on deteriorating conditions in these countries and their government's unwillingness or inability to provide us with reliable information, I am going to put a temporary pause while I take a look at our procedures for just these six countries. And I think that evidence in the order on its face bears a rational relationship to what the president did. And if you treat it as rational basis review, which is what this court in Johnson said that the Mandel-Fiallo standard is, that it's rational basis review, and other circuits have agreed with that. The Second Circuit in Raja agreed with it. Under rational basis, I don't think there'd be any question that in any other context, if we had a law that set out factual findings like this, we'd say that survives rational basis.
So going back to Judge King's question, that there were 40 days, and Judge Mott, there were 50 days had elapsed in the 90-day period already. So the government had 50 days to do their vetting, presumably to add more to the record. Was any vetting done in those 50 days?
So, Judge Sacker, I think the first part is right, but I just want to disagree with the second, which is we did do some work. Those departments were required to produce a report to the president.
Within 30 days, they were supposed to give a report to the president.
That's right, but part of the reason, Judge King, that the 90-day period exists is to free up resources in those departments so that they can do the review. And instead, what we've been doing since January 27th is just litigating this order. We do not have that report yet, and so I can't say to the court what the State Department's and Homeland Security Department's final...
The district court in the Ninth Circuit only enjoined Sections 2 and 6. So you still have Sections 4, 5, 8, and 9 directing the application of Iraqi nationals for entry should be subjected to thorough review, directing the implementation of uniform baseline for screening and vetting. All those things are in order now. You've got this uniform baseline for vetting and screening. You've expedited completion and implementation of biometric entry-exit tracking system.
My understanding, Judge Motz, is Iraq is no longer part of 2C, obviously. There has been work done on Iraq, and there has been work, this is the most important thing, under Section...
But you just decided that Iraq is not... So that, how does that show us that you're furthering the terms of this order? You said you couldn't further 2 and 6 because they're enjoined, but I'm talking about 4, 5, 8, and 9.
Yes, I only meant to say the other sections have not been enjoined, and we have been moving forward, and the most relevant section is Section 5. Uh-huh. Which says we can look at our vetting procedures for all nations across the board, and we have been doing that. My understanding is that there has been substantial progress in state and homeland security. They haven't released anything yet, but they've done a lot of work on it. But what they have not done in doing that is anything specific to the listed countries, because we have read ourselves to be barred by the Hawaii injunction from doing that. So there is work going on the biometric screening. There is work going on raising the standards across the board. But what we're talking about here are just the standards for these six countries, and that we have not been doing any work on since March 16th.
Let me take you back to standing for just a second. I know the government takes the position that none of the plaintiffs that the district court accorded standing to have standing. But do you differentiate for standing purposes between those seeking an immigrant visa as opposed to a non-immigrant visa?
Well, we don't think it makes any difference, Judge Agee. I think our standing analysis would go like this. We're down to Section 2C. They put forward four plaintiffs in the district court, four individual plaintiffs who said we have a relative overseas whose entry will be delayed by Section 2C. Three of those plaintiffs have now dropped out. One, because her sister is waiting for years anyway, and they concede, I think, they haven't argued her in their briefs.
Now, all four are for immigrant visas?
I don't know offhand. I'll know for you on rebuttal whether they're immigrant or non-immigrant. I believe they're all immigrant visas. And the other two have received visas now, and we would say their claims are moot. I think we're really now down to one plaintiff who still has a relative overseas, John Doe 1, who wants his wife to be able to come in. We've disputed whether he's got Article 3 injury because it's speculative and she's almost certain to get a waiver if, in fact, she's married to him. But even if you disagreed with that, I think our basic point would be the court's been clear again and again that where you are alleging government conduct that discriminates on whatever basis, religion or something else, it's got to be the putative victim that brings that claim. And here, this runs to the aliens abroad. And so John Doe 1 doesn't have standing to raise, in effect, an Establishment Clause claim on behalf of his wife. And I think plaintiffs implicitly recognize that, and that's why they try to reframe the injury as a message of condemnation that just flows out to the community. And for the reasons we give in our brief, if you accepted that move under Establishment Clause standing, I think Valley Forge would be wrongly decided, and I think you would basically eviscerate standing limitations.
Mr. Wall, let's get back to the facial legitimacy issue. In Executive Order Number 2, the President specifically stated that Executive Number Order 1 did not provide a basis for discriminating for or against members of any particular religion. If we find that that is incorrect on its face, that it did, what does that do to the facial legitimacy of Executive Order Number 2 if it, in fact, is relying on a statement that is incorrect?
Well, I think, first, the President said that in the context of the provision about religious minorities that was removed. And he said, look, that was religious minorities across the board. It was Christians in some nations.
Right.
It was Muslims in Myanmar.
But the order, Executive Order Number 2, affirmatively states that Number 1 did not provide a basis for discriminating or against or for any particular religion. And if we find that's incorrect, does that not undermine, or does it, undermine the facial legitimacy of Executive Order Number 2 if it's based on something that's incorrect?
I don't think so. I mean, look, however far their taint theory runs, I think even if you thought it infected the First Order, right, the President went back and in response to concerns that courts had raised, concerns with which he disagreed, but nevertheless revised the order, took out a number of categories of aliens who were alleged to have due process rights, took out the provision on religious minorities, took out the indefinite suspension of Syrian refugees, I mean, responded seriatim to all the concerns that courts had raised. And now we're right back here, and the question is, well, can we just infer that whatever we thought of the First Order was true of the Second? And I think the answer is no, because although I'd say the First Order was fine, at least the President...
Why does the Second Order say that? Do you see what I'm saying? The fact that the Second Order affirmatively states that there was no discriminatory intent with the First Order, where does that leave us as far as the intent in the Second Order?
With respect, Judge Keenan, I think that was a... I think any President faced with the judicial decisions that the President had here would have said exactly the same thing. He said, look, I put in a provision that was supposed to protect religious minorities. I didn't mean that to operate on the basis of any particular religion. I meant it equally for Muslims in Myanmar as for Christians in other nations. Some courts disagreed, and he came with the statement you're talking about, and he said, I never intended that to discriminate on the basis of any particular religion, but because...
But they were 99% Muslim, so it had to be a religion other than Muslim.
Not with respect,
and I think the President said something about being Christian on a TV program.
So, Judge King, with the provision that the Second Order is talking about there was just one that gave preference in admitting refugees to religious minorities. And the President said, I didn't mean that to operate only for any particular religion, but because courts were concerned, I took it out. And I think, Judge Keenan, in the face of some of these decisions that showed real hostility to the President, I think it would have been a remarkable thing for him not to come back and say, I did not mean the things that courts have been attributing to me, but just to prove it, I took out the parts of the order that they found problematic.
Which of his statements are relevant here? The statements that he made during the campaign, the statements before these orders, the statement after the Ninth Circuit, or where is it that we look at this President's statement and determine what he is saying?
Judge Nguyen, I give you a number of different answers, but let me start with, I think, the most basic one. Under the right legal standard, which is Mandel, what the Supreme Court said is courts will not look behind once we know it's facially legitimate and bona fide
that.
Or rational.
We don't consider Dinn, but there's Dinn, and there's Justice Kenneth's concurrence, and he then adds in that there is this affirmative duty to sort of look at if there's bad faith. And to determine in bad faith, don't we get to consider what was actually said here and said very explicitly, even after the Second Order, there was sort of a wink and nod that, well, you know what I mean, even though it was changed. Does that make a difference?
So, Judge Nguyen, let me just say a couple quick things, all right? Mandel says courts will not look behind to extrinsic material, and the court declined to
look. The district court said Mandel didn't apply. He said it's a Lemon case.
That's right. The district court did set aside Mandel, even though this court and the Supreme Court have consistently applied
it. In the establishment clause case, you've got to look at the purpose. That's the first part of this, of the Lemon test, he said. You're looking at the purpose. And if you look at purpose, he said that opens up looking behind it and seeing what the real purpose was. And that takes you back to what's been said. What's been said. And he went all the way back to November of 2015 and brought it up to the present, to the time he signed off on the executive order, when he said, everybody knows what I mean here.
Judge King, yes. If the court disagrees with us and says, look, we think the body of domestic establishment clause precedent that the courts have developed in dealing with constitutional claims by U.S. citizens gets exported to the border, where the president is excluding aliens in what is only a, can only be a Youngstown 1 case. Everything he has under Article 2 and everything Congress can give him under 1182F. If you think all those cases like McCreary and Lukumi equally travel to the border, and it's not Mandel, which is what has always governed constitutional challenges to the denial of entry of aliens abroad, then yes, you're looking at purpose.
That's how you're getting that up at a abuse of discretion here, claiming it's a legal error to apply Lemon instead of Mandel. Is that what...
Your Honor, we think there were a handful of legal errors below, but that's certainly one of them.
Is that the primary one you're focused on?
We think that he applied the wrong legal standard.
They applied the Mandel case instead of the Lemon case.
That's right. But I want to get back to Judge
Wayne. The Mandel case is the Kleindienst case.
That's right. That's right. But I want to take Judge Wynn's question on its own terms, right? If you disagree with us that Mandel is the applicable standard, and we're just in domestic establishment clause world.
But also give me at least your assessment of what Justice Kennedy meant when he spoke in the plurality opinion and then. And he said, absent an affirmative showing of bad faith. That seems to be something of an expansion beyond simply saying you just give us a reason.
All right, so now I think there's two, you put two questions on the table, Judge Wynn, that are the heart of the case. What does this bad faith exception do under Mandel, if that's where we are? And what does a purpose inquiry look like under McCreary County and Lukumi and all our domestic cases? And I want to take them in turn. On the bad faith exception, the courts never applied it. To be sure, in dicta, Justice Kennedy and Justice Alito indicated it was there. But look at what they said. They said it requires an affirmative showing of bad faith. If that's true for a single one-off decision by a consular officer, we should require only the strongest, clearest showing of bad faith in order to impugn a formal national security determination of the president entered after consultation with multiple cabinet officials. That's a remarkable thing, and the bar ought to be very high. And what we're talking about here are reaching back to a handful of campaign statements where I think, in fairness, in the Southeastern Legal Foundation brief...
campaign statements, all this stuff was reaffirmed after the election. You have stuff after the election.
Let me be more specific to Judge King's question. At the signing of shortly after the Executive Order 2 was signed, Sean Spicer said the principles remain the same. President Trump's statement at the concurrent with that time, you know my plans. Spicer, President Trump yesterday continued to deliver on campaign promises. Is there anything other than willful blindness that would prevent us from getting behind those statements?
Yes, Judge Floyd. Respect for the head of a coordinate branch and the presumption that officials act legally, which is to say the presumption of regularity. I think the Southeastern Legal Foundation, in Part 3 of its brief, does a great job of walking through
the Constitution, not just respect for the person. It's the Constitution, is it not?
No question, Chief Judge Gregory, but I think what the President made clear, and granted, he clarified this over time, but he made clear in the months leading up to the election and after the inauguration that what he was talking about was the threat from terrorist groups that operate in particular countries that have been designated as state sponsors of terror or designated as countries of concern because they are safe havens for terrorists. He made clear he was not talking about Muslims all over the world, and that's why this is not a Muslim ban. Its text doesn't have anything to do with religion. Its operation doesn't have anything to do with religion. The only thing they've got are to reach back and say, well, we know, despite its text and operation, what was in the president's head. And I think there's different ways to read those statements. And respect for a coordinate branch and a presumption of regularity, I think, require reading them in a way that is not most hostile to the president, but would render this action lawful.
Mr. Wall.
Sorry, I was going to go back to one of Judge Keenan's questions, so maybe I should. But you had said in responding to her a few minutes ago that you didn't see anything wrong with the first executive order. And I just wonder, given all your arguments, what would be wrong with a ban on Muslims, in your view?
Oh, Judge Watts, I think that would run straight into Mandel's constitutional limit about facial legitimacy.
You do.
I think it's hard to imagine that a president who said that and an order that achieved that on its face or in operation wouldn't run afoul of Mandel. But here we have an order that on its face and in operation does not actually do anything on the basis of religion.
Counsel, can I just ask you to elaborate on the first thing you said? I'm sorry.
Sure.
It would run into Mandel because even if the president made a national security determination that Muslims couldn't safely be admitted to the country, the courts could look behind that and say that's not okay?
No, I think it raises a serious question, Judge Harris, about whether using religion as a proxy in that way would be a facially legitimate reason for Mandel purposes.
Not what you said in response to my question.
No, sorry.
Changing, I think.
I meant to say the same thing, which is that if a president, unlike this, came in and had an executive order that actually did ban Muslims, and he said, I'm doing it for national security purposes, I think that would be, it's hard to imagine that courts would say, or the Supreme Court would say, that that's a facially legitimate reason
who would
under Mandel.
Who would have standing for that kind of a claim, under your theory of standing?
Well, I think United States citizens could raise Mandel-type claims or Dinn-type claims, saying that the right to marry and a protected liberty interest under the Due Process Clause or the First Amendment right to receive information. But I think it's notable that that's not the claim they've raised here. They haven't come in with a due process claim or anything like it. It's just an Establishment Clause claim. And it's an Establishment Clause claim based on government conduct, not religious speech. And the court's been clear again and again that where you have conduct, it's the targets of the conduct that have standing to sue, not third parties.
Your position, as I've heard you answer it, I think it is, we just look at the face of the executive order in this case, and you would look at the face of it and see if there's anything in the face which calls into question a religious ban or a Muslim ban, correct?
I think it's a little more than that. It's rational basis review under Mandel, Judge said, so I think it's on its face, but it's also could a reasonable government actor have linked up this purpose of national security?
Well, I was
and
really
what
talking
the,
about it in terms of if there is a national security issue that's linked in, then it would just be the question of facially what it does. And you think that is because that's out of respect for the coordinate branch of government?
I think under Mandel, because keep in mind what's on the other side. In the Washington case, they wanted years' worth of discovery and up to 30 depositions of executive branch officials to inquire into what everyone who put this executive order together actually meant by it. And facing that in Mandel, the court said, we're not going to look behind Justice Marshall. It's rational basis review.
Okay, Mr. Wall, I do understand that, but I just want to be sure I understand your answer to my question. If the president issued what was called a ban against Muslims from these six countries, with every national security with exactly the same otherwise in the order, you believe that would be constitutional?
And just to make sure I understand, Judge Motz, it's an order that blocks only Muslims from these listed countries and not all nationals?
All nationals, because he's worried about Muslims.
So in text and operation, it does not operate on the basis of religion, but the president makes more unequivocal statements than what we have here.
It's in
the way he characterizes an otherwise neutral law. I think under Mandel, no, you wouldn't look behind it, but you don't need to agree with me about that. Because I think that the fallback argument, which I think is a pretty powerful one, is that even if you thought that those statements ought to be given some weight, we had some pretty constitutionally significant events here. The president was elected. He took an oath to uphold the Constitution. He formed a government. He consulted with his administration.
That doesn't give him the right to violate the Establishment Clause.
I don't think so, Judge Motz, but I do think it should color the way that we reach back and look at previous statements before he was an elected official, before he faced the demands of government, before he consulted with an administration and took an oath that allowed him to occupy the nation's highest office. And even if you disagreed with me over all of that, and you thought, look, the government's wrong about all those legal arguments, I ought to just read the statement straight up like a McCreary case and see what I think they say. I still think the statements are ambiguous, and out of respect and the presumption of regularity, I think what you'd say is we don't give the president the least charitable interpretation of what he said. We give it the most reasonable interpretation in order to render the executive order lawful so that it shouldn't drift in and out of constitutionality based on what we think was in the head of the president who issued it.
Has the president ever repudiated the campaign statements that he made on a Muslim ban?
Judge King, he has. And again, as I say, some of the briefs walk through this. He said, look, over time, I've made clear.
Well, he changed it from religion to nationality. He explained that he wasn't going to call it religion anymore. He was going to call it nationality, and Mayor Giuliani advised him to do it that way. He did do that.
Territories.
He's going to be territories. But he's never repudiated what he said about the Muslim ban. It's still on his website. The district court here found that it's on his website, campaign website, today, or as of the day that he wrote the opinion.
Judge King, it is an archived press statement from 16 months ago, before we got into a campaign, and we had a primary and election, and we took an oath, and we formed a government. But the point, I think Judge Moss was getting at this,
you don't challenge any of the findings of fact that the district court made.
Well, because Judge King...
he said it.
They're not findings of fact. When this court looks at what
the
a lower
court found facts, that's what district courts do in preliminary injunction cases.
We're not disputing the statements occurred as a matter of fact, though the president clarified over time that he was talking about territories and terrorism, not religion. But our point is just when you're doing rational basis review, or even if you're doing McCreary and Lukumi and all the rest, the purpose prong of Lemon, a rational basis review, these are not factual questions subject to clear error review. Courts have always treated them de novo.
The claim was any error, clear error. You don't allege that there are any facts in the district court's opinion that he found that are clearly erroneous.
Because the only...
I look for that.
The only facts, Judge King, are the statements, and we don't dispute as a matter of fact that the statements occur. But the legal effect and consequences of those statements, whether under Mandel or McCreary, that's always been treated as a question of law. When we look at legislative history or anything else to divine purpose, we don't treat it as a factual question subject to clear error review. It's a legal question that this court reviews de novo.
Hey, Mr. Wall, I'm sorry.
No, please.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. Mr. Wall, I'm concerned about the absence of any linkage in Executive Order Number 2 to the nationals of these countries. In other words, Executive Order Number 2 talks about these countries are the governments are not well operating, that problems are occurring in their own evaluation processes. But what does the Executive Order 2 say about the nationals of these countries that make them detrimental to the interests of the United States if they are allowed to go through normal channels?
Well, Judge Keenan, it's got a couple of examples for an Iraqi national and a Somali national and refugees, but I think this is the key response to what you're saying is I think plaintiffs have really misframed the question.
Well, you're talking about 82 million people, aren't you?
Right, but the president wasn't.
So doesn't the? It seems to me there has to be some linkage to show that there's a detrimental interest to the United States posed by 82 million people. There has to be something about those people's nationality that renders them suspect or renders them dangerous. And I don't see anything in the text of EO2 that does that. Can you point us to anything that says that because these people come from this country, they are detrimental to the interests of the United States?
So with all respect, two things, Judge Keenan. One, I think it misframes the question a little bit. The president wasn't suspending the entry of these nationals because he believes they're all terrorists. What he was saying was the previous administration and Congress designated these countries and their nationals, took them out of the visa waiver program because of their links to terrorist organizations. I'm not sure whether our vetting procedures are sufficient.
But 1182F, if you go back to the language of the statute, says the president has to find that the entry of aliens or any class of alien into the United States would be detrimental. It doesn't say may be detrimental. Would be detrimental to the interests of the United States. So what in the text, I'm looking for it, what in the text of Executive Order Number 2 supports the conclusion that these aliens from these countries, these 82 million people, would be detrimental to the interests of the United States.
So I think what's in there, and it's mostly in Section 1, is the President said, look, the previous administration took nationals and people with connections to these countries, dual nationals, out of the visa waiver program. He walked through and he said that their conditions in these countries have continued to deteriorate, as have some of their relationships with the United States, as in the cases of Iran and Syria. I, therefore, am going to suspend it just to look at the vetting procedures, and it gave some examples of nationals from the listed countries who had been terror threats, and then, of course, the pieces on refugees, which are not before the court. And I think what the President was saying was not, I know that all these people coming in are dangerous. What he was saying was, I want a brief opportunity, as the previous President had, to assure myself that the procedures we have in place are actually enough and we shouldn't be doing more. And in the meantime,
wasn't
because
the
I'm not certain.
Wasn't the primary example from Iraq, and Iraq is not now included in the second ban?
Well, there were two. One was an Iraqi national, one was a Somali national. But again, I don't think what the President was saying was, I know them all to be dangerous. He was saying, I'm not certain. And so I just want to put a brief pause. I'll allow individualized waivers if the State Department and Homeland Security tell me that there's no threat to the nation when someone's coming in.
I'm not certain, but the statutory language, if the President is saying I'm not certain, the statutory language says he has to find that these nationals would be detrimental to the interests of the United States. And it sounds to me like you're saying, the President is saying, gee, they may be detrimental. Do you meet the requirement of the statute that the President has to find that they would be detrimental?
Absolutely, Judge Keenan. I'm not aware of any courts ever second-guessing the President's national interest determination under 1182F. But in any event, here what he said is, I find that it would be detrimental to let in people from countries we know to be dangerous that have deteriorated over time until I have had a chance, working with my cabinet officials, to assess the vetting procedures for those countries. He said it would be detrimental in the face of that uncertainty. That is a reasonable finding, one that an executive branch official could draw. I think there's no question that it should survive rational basis review, and that's why plaintiffs have really tried to leverage the domestic establishment clause precedent and say, look, this is a Lemon case, this is a McCreary case, let's talk about subjective motivations. But Judge Wynn, to finally work back to your question, even in that context, what McCreary says is, what we care about is official objectives, right? We care about official acts. What is it that the government actors did that shows what this conduct is supposed to be? And if there's anything that campaign statements over a 16-month course before this executive order was actually put down on paper don't show, it's the official objective for government conduct. And that's why I think even...
Let me ask you about that. Have we ever known any time in history we've had this, where you have such very definitive, specific statements before, and then afterwards, within 7 days, a policy or regulation or executive order is entered in which effectively the effect of it is there? And even if it's later revived, it seems as though the effect is there of the very thing that specifically you say you would do. Have we ever had that kind of a situation in history?
I mean, Judge, when there are a handful of cases we point to in our brief.
I want to know, have we had that happen in history, that we've had anybody who was ascended to the presidency take that position, where it is very pointed of Muslims, absolutely just not people we want in this country, and then you then enact a executive order within 7 days that's declared by the courts to be unconstitutional, then you revise it. But the effect and even the statements, as Judge King pointed out earlier, that are made is, you know, well, this you know what this means, or this is effectively the same thing, you know, whether it's the press secretary or whomever there. Have we had that in history? I mean, every other instance, even if President Reagan and President Bush and others, they've been more specific. Never the national policy, specific individuals from that country. It was a government official who did certain things in cases like that. But have we had that?
Judge Wynn, candidates talk about things on the campaign trail all the time. And no, we haven't had a lot of litigation over them because the right legal standards here don't allow for inquiries into subjective motivations.
Well, we are in uncharted territory, I think, to you.
In the sense that the district court accepted here what I think is unprecedented, which is it set aside a law that is neutral on its face and neutral in its operations because it performed the kind of psychoanalysis that McCreary forecloses. Now, you put your finger on the best statement, and I'll give this to them, which is the we all know what this means. But even there, The president and his advisors for months had been talking about ISIS and Al-Qaeda, Islamic terrorist groups that pose a threat to the nation. When he looked at the title of the order, which is protecting us from foreign terrorist entry, and he looked up and said, we all know what this means. The reasonable reading is not the one the plaintiffs give to it. It's the president was talking about countries and groups that may intend to do us harm. And certainly in the face of ambiguity over what the commander-in-chief and head of the executive branch meant by an offhand six-word statement, this court ought to, I think, take that statement not at its least reasonable, not at its least permissible, but in a way that it was in accord with what the president and his advisors had been talking about for months, which was terrorism.
Mr. Wall, over here. I don't think the district court suggested, as you seem to imply, that he completely ignored national security concerns. As I understand, the district court's rationale is that he wasn't going to second-guess national security concerns, but he found that those were secondary to the real purpose of the objective of the president. Now, you may disagree with respect to the application of the Lemon test, but if we find that that test applies, what's wrong with that analysis?
Well, because I think there are a couple of errors of law that got you there. First, where you've got a law that's neutral on its face and in operation, you can't reach back to campaign statements by people in their capacities as a private...
Well, counsel, I'm sorry, can I just ask you, what do you mean by neutral in operation? I mean, clearly the law has a disparate impact on Muslims. So in what sense is it neutral in op... Usually when we talk about, you know, on its face and in operation, we mean... On its face, it's neutral, but in operation, it has a disparate impact on the group that is alleged to be targeted. So how is this neutral as to its, in its operation as to Muslims?
Judge Harris,
it's... And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to get you off. Just,
no, no,
I said
no,
that a couple of times, and I just literally don't know what you mean.
Yeah, so let me see if I can cover both. The law operates to suspend the entry of all nationals of the listed countries without regard to religion. That would have a disparate impact, I grant you, for countries that are majority Muslim, but so would every action that we undertake under the immigration laws with respect to those countries.
So it's not neutral in impact on Muslims. It has a disparate impact on Muslims, this order.
Oh, but that's never been, when the Supreme Court talked in Lukumi about a religious gerrymander or a law that in operation is not permissible, it wasn't talking in disparate impact terms, and it couldn't have been, because actions may fall disparately on various religions in a given community. What it was talking about was something that wasn't a religious gerrymander. In other words, it wasn't something that was meant to harm a particular religion, like Santeria and Lukumi, but it had just been disguised on its face with some other rationale. And here, no one disputes that in its operation, every national of the listed countries, whatever their religion, has to go through exactly the same process when they show up at the consulate. And if the argument then is, well, but that has a disparate impact on Muslims, I mean, so too would have taking nationals in these countries out of the visa waiver program, for instance, or designating them as state sponsors of terrorism, which kicked in any number of requirements under the statute, or countries of concern. I don't think this court would want to go down the road of saying that...
I'm asking what you meant by neutral.
No, no, so I mean not a religious gerrymander within the meaning of Lukumi. And so I think that's where the court has been on these. It said, is it facially legitimate? And then in the domestic context, it's taken this additional, all right, do we have a religious gerrymander under Lukumi? And if we don't, then it's okay. And what plaintiffs, I think, want to do is take it an extra step and say, well, but what we care about is the subjective motivations of the people who put this in place. And even if some president or some administration could have done this, this president did it for an impermissible motive. And what we're saying is, under Mandel or McCreary, I don't think you can get there. That's a bridge too far to do that. And just to
but under McCreary, we're supposed to look at the purpose. We're supposed to be the objective observer and find the purpose. That's like the motivation, isn't it? Or the intent, the purpose.
Yes, but now, and I think this weaves in the answer I was going to give to Judge Diaz, which is it's still an official objective, which means you can't look at campaign statements. And even if you thought I were wrong about that as a matter of law, you still ought to say that generally they shouldn't get much weight because you haven't taken the oath of office to uphold the Constitution. You haven't formed an administration or consulted with them. And at least on the facts of this case, if you disagreed with me about both of those things, you'd say, look, the statements were ambiguous. The president clarified over time that what he was talking about were countries and territories that have known links to groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and taken in the light most favorable to the executive, because of our respect for a coordinate branch and the presumption of regularity, we're not going to read those statements to say that the president was talking about something impermissible. I think you'd have to reject all three of those arguments to get where plaintiffs want to go.
So if the statements were less ambiguous, could you consider them? In other words, if the president, as a candidate for the office, had said every day, my first day in office, I'm going to impose a Muslim ban, and then his first day of office, he issued a Muslim ban. You aren't arguing that you couldn't consider his statements of intent as a candidate, are you?
Not if you were just applying McCreary and Lukumi. I think under Mandel, now you're like Mandel, right? Justice Marshall saying, look, court, if you take just a peek behind the reason the AG gave, they denied this guy because he was a communist, and there's evidence in the record that shows it. And the court said, we're not looking at it. This is rational basis
so
review.
You're saying then the president could say that every day as a candidate for a year. I intend to ban Muslims. They are bad people. And then the first day in office, he does that. You're saying that none of those statements could be considered. We would only be considering the facial legitimacy of the order itself.
Judge Keenan, obviously we think you don't need to get into any of that here because
right,
the law is not a Muslim ban, but I take your question.
What
right?
I'm trying to get at is, do you really mean that we can't consider all the statements, or does it depend on what gloss you put on the statements, how you view them? I'm concerned whether this is a subjective analysis on some people's part, or whether it is truly objective.
So I think under the Supreme Court's decision in Mandel, it says you shouldn't look behind. But if you think that it's got the bad faith exception that Judge Wynn and I were talking about, I think the kind of hypothetical you're playing out might rise to the level of that clear, strong, affirmative showing that you'd say, all right, even though it's the President of the United States and even though it's national security, we'll look behind it. But I think at a minimum what the hypothetical illustrates is how far we are from what we ought to require to do such a remarkable thing, to second guess and to essentially say that the President is not.
You need to be very careful. Because you're saying that might rise to bad faith, but you're laying the standard that bad faith is in the eye of the beholder. And so you're cracking that door. I'm just saying you realize you're doing that, which is in a justification to look at what he said, and then we just weigh whether or not he meant it or didn't mean it.
So, Judge Shedd, what I meant to say is,
keep in mind, it's not just you and I that are talking about it. It was Justice Kennedy in the plurality opinion of Dinn who brought it up first.
So
then you and I started talking.
What I meant to say, Judge Shedd, is we think the door is shut.
I thought you just opened it.
But if you think, I'm not going to, but if you think Justices Kennedy and Alito cracked open the door and you think that exception is there, courts never applied it, and interestingly, that concurrence, Judge Wynn, cites to the part of Mandel where Mandel reserves the question if the president has no justification. So it's not entirely clear to me what Justice Kennedy and Alito were getting at by the bad faith exception. But if you think it's there, then maybe that's the kind of thing, Judge Keenan and Judge Shedd, that would get you home. But no, it's not our frontline position.
Well, I'm going to close the door. Thank you, Mr. Wall.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court.
Counsel, let me ask you, I started with the opposing counsel. Counsel for the government has represented that of the four plaintiffs the district court found had standing, only one remains, John Doe number one, to have standing in their view. Do you agree or disagree with that? And if so, what's the basis now for standing for any of the plaintiffs other than number one?
Sure. I mean, and obviously, to be clear, one plaintiff withstanding is enough. However, and John Doe 1, I think, is the individual plaintiff who has the clearest standing of our individual plaintiffs because he is here. He's in the United States. He is a Muslim who is injured by the order, by the message that the order sends, which is a real Establishment Clause injury. And his injury is particularized in a way that...
Now, what about the other three, though? Where do they stand now?
So John Doe Threes currently has standing because his wife is overseas. She has a visa, but she would, I think, be banned if she came in. But
you would or wouldn't?
Sorry, Your Honor. In light of the government's most recent representation, I think the government agrees that or has represented that she would be let in. So he has standing, but a less a more distant standing because his he is still injured by the order, but doesn't have the same particularized connection to the ongoing effect of the order that John Doe 1 does, because his wife will be able to come into the country.
And who has standing to raise the issue of non-immigrant visas? Am I understanding correctly that of the four plaintiffs, they all dealt with immigrant visas, or is there anybody who's got a non-immigrant visa in the mix?
I believe that there are members of MESA, one of the organizational plaintiffs.
Right, but the district court only found four folks had standing. It didn't address anybody else. So of those four, who's your candidate to raise the non-immigrant e-visa issue?
Yeah, I don't believe any of those individual plaintiffs is applying for a non-immigrant visa on the part of a loved one.
Could the district court's injunction get to non-immigrant visas as well as immigrant visas?
Yes, Your Honor, because the Establishment Clause claim reaches is not specific to any visa type, and there's no differentiation in the provision that's enjoined of the order that says, you know, we're going to enjoin immigrant visas in one way and non-immigrant visas
right,
in
I
another.
I understand that, but my question goes back to who before the court, this court now, of the folks that raised, that the district court found to have standing, if none of them have standing to raise the non-immigrant visa issue because none of them have that in the mix, what's the authority to address the non-immigrant visa?
The statutory claim with respect to non-immigrant visas?
Either one of them. If you don't have a plaintiff who raises that as an issue, that's not their skin in the game, so to speak. How does the non-immigrant visa issue get before the court?
So to start with the Establishment Clause, Your Honor, with respect to the Establishment Clause, the individual plaintiffs in this case and the clients and members of the organizational plaintiffs, they are alleging or actually have put forward evidence that they're injured by the order's suspension of entry. Not only with respect to immigrant visas, not only with respect to non-immigrant visas, but because it is embodying the message of condemnation to their religion. That is the quintessence of an Establishment Clause violation.
Right, but except for the four, the district court didn't pass judgment on any of the other plaintiffs. So it would seem like that if we were to determine that of the four they didn't have standing, it would have to go back to the district court to address the standing of all the other plaintiffs in the first instance.
But I don't think there's any
direct yourself to the Establishment Clause, because your colleague on the other side has talked to us a good bit about Valley Forge. And why doesn't that doom your Establishment Clause claim here?
Because the plaintiffs in this case are nothing like the plaintiffs in Valley Forge, Your Honor.
And how so?
The plaintiffs in Valley Forge were complaining about a localized event. First of all, Valley Forge obviously didn't involve a condemnation claim. And actually, the plaintiffs in Valley Forge did not allege any kind of religious injury at all.
A First Amendment religion claim, right?
Yes. But they didn't allege that their religious beliefs, their ability to kind of feel like full members of the community, any of those things were injured by the land transfer that was at essence in Valley Forge. And, of course, most significantly, they had no proximity, either physical or in any other way, to the events that they were complaining about. They read about them in the newspaper.
What proximity do your clients have? Your
this,
four?
Yes, Your
Two
Honor.
Of them have, or three of them have gone, right? I guess I thought in response to my colleague, you were trying to make the argument that even those people who we've discounted, who we think have helped, have some sort of proximity
or establishment clause claim and have sufficient proximity to make one. Is that what you were saying?
Yes, but let's start with the plaintiff who has the clearest proximity, Your Honor, and then maybe we can zoom out from there. John Doe 1 has a very strong, particularized connection to the order because he is not just a Muslim. He is not just part of the political community that is being affected by this order. But his family relations are being impacted by the order in the most direct way. His ability to be with his family member is implicated by the order. And so instead of...
It wasn't sufficient in Fiallo.
Fiallo obviously wasn't an Establishment Clause case, Your Honor.
Right, but it dealt specifically with familial relationship. I mean, that was the essence of the claim they were bringing.
And it wasn't a... But I don't think there was an issue about standing in Fiallo either, Your Honor. I mean, I think in terms of standing, it's clear that... John Doe 1 is injured by the order, and that injury has the kind of proximity, the particularized connection to the order that's at hand to take away any of the concerns that the Valley Forge Court had about allowing an abstract
clause cases seem to there seems to be some direct exposure to a plaintiff. They saw the Ten Commandments in the courthouse, or they got a letter from the school board or something like that. There seems to be some objective display directly to the plaintiffs of some tangible event that they see and participate in. This seems to be somewhat far removed from those cases like Surrey and some of the others. So what's your best case that supports your Establishment Clause claim here?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I think this is a more severe and more direct injury than the one in cases like Surrey, because
Surrey is our case back in 19, Judge Wilkinson's opinion.
That's right, Your Honor.
And it was an Establishment Clause.
That's right.
The Ten Commandments case, he's told.
Right. And it was acknowledged in that case that Surrey had
let me ask you, shift gears.
Yes,
Your scintillating,
Honor.
But I won't ask this of you. I want to understand your theory. We'll come back to that and mesh that out. I'm going to give you a hypothetical. If, in this hypothetical, the president has a clear animus against a religious group, and then it becomes clear to everybody, that religious group is then involved in an issue that's causing some national security issue to the U.S., may that president act in any way against that group, or is that president with the animus disqualified from acting because of that animus?
Oh, so I think it's a two-part answer, Your Honor. First, I think that if the government was actually acting in a facially...
No, I just asked you my question. A president has an animus against a group.
Yes.
And then the group presents a clear national defense risk. Everybody agrees to that. May the president take action notwithstanding his or her animus, or is that president disqualified operating on that risk because of the animus?
No, Your Honor. The animus is not permanently disqualifying for any circumstance. What the question...
So that the president then, in that situation, could take action if there is a national security risk?
Your Honor, I think the president could take action if it would appear to the reasonable, objective observer that his purpose was not to forward his animus, to advance his animus, but in fact
his primary
was for
purpose?
A secular...
You mean his primary purpose?
Yes, Your Honor.
Let me ask you to follow up
on that then. If a different candidate had won the election and then issued this order, I gather you wouldn't have any problem with that.
Well, McCreary teaches us...
A different candidate who did not make the same expressions as President Trump did.
Yes, Your Honor. I think McCreary and other cases teach us that the same action could be constitutional in some circumstances and not in others.
My particular question is, if some other candidate had won the election and issued this executive order that's before us, I gather you would have no problem with that. Is that right?
Uh, I, I just want to clarify the hypothetical in one sense, Your Honor. Because are we saying that the candidate or the then president issued the order after consulting with agencies, not over the objection that agencies had that, in fact, it would not serve a national security purpose?
Set that aside. We have an order on its face. We can read this order. And we have no antecedent statements by a candidate about this order. We have a candidate who won the presidency, some candidate other than President Trump won the presidency and then chose to issue this particular order with whatever counsel he took, whether it's his personal advisor in the White House or with the Secretary of State, Homeland Security or National Security or whatever. He issued this executive order. Do I understand that just in that circumstance, the executive order should be honored?
Yes, Your Honor. I think in that case, it could be constitutional. However, Your Honor, I think that it's important to understand that this order, even taking all of the purpose out of it, even if it were
so
for...
You basically want to set aside the prescription of Mandel, which says an order such as this, which on its face is legitimate, becomes illegitimate because of campaign statements that were made by the candidate for president.
Not at all, Your Honor. I think we should...
It seems to follow from that.
Are you agreeing that the order is legitimate on its face?
No, Your Honor. So
why not?
Let me start from the
point. Just answer a question. Is it legitimate on its face or not, in your opinion?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because the order is completely unprecedented in our nation's history. Even with a secular purpose, there is no...
The first order on anything is invalid?
No, Your Honor. But you would expect that an order that took as drastic an action as this, there's never been a multi-country ban ordered by the president. Even in the months after 9/11...
The previous president issued a restriction on non-immigrant visas from these countries plus Iraq. Isn't that right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Didn't the previous administration issue orders that restricted immigration from these countries plus Iraq?
No, Your Honor. All the previous administration did was require people to apply for visas who would otherwise not be required to apply for visas.
Took them out of the non-visa program, the program, because of the risk of the persons who would be coming from these countries. Isn't that why they did it?
No, Your Honor. I think the judgment and the brief of the national security officials goes into this with some detail. The judgment of the previous administration was that people who were dual nationals from other countries who had either traveled to or in some cases were dual nationals of these countries.
Your problem with this order facially is it's the first of its kind?
No, Your Honor.
What about the text of the order? What about what the order says renders it facially illegitimate?
Well, I think if you look at...
Or is it facially illegitimate?
If you look at the reasoning of the order, sticking to the four corners of the order itself, if you look at the reasoning in the order says these are countries who, based on... And again, if you ignore the fact that current national security officials have determined that it actually does not serve a national security purpose.
Why
don't you stick to the face of the order? You keep bringing in these extraneous facts. The question to you is the face of this order legitimate?
Right. And if you look at the face of the order, Your Honor, if you look at the process that's laid out in the order for identifying these countries, if you look at the brief of the interfaith organizations, and you actually consider the same sources, that's cited in this order, you would come up with a different list of countries, including non-Muslim countries.
But what's wrong with the face of this order? You keep going off into tangents. What's wrong on the face of this order? Tell us specifically where it goes wrong in the language of the order.
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is that there's a logical problem with the order in that if you try to apply the logic in the order, you would come up with a conclusion different, a policy different than the
order itself. You mean they list six countries that are state sponsors of terrorism, that provide havens for terrorism, that are basically not functioning with governments in some of these countries, and are high risks. People coming from those countries are determined to be high risks. That's what's stated in the order. And you're saying that that is something wrong with that? The reasoning of that?
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is that if you apply that reasoning, this is not the list of countries that you actually come up with.
I thought you didn't want these countries covered. Are you now arguing that you want more countries covered? That's what it sounds like you're saying.
No, Your Honor. I'm saying that if this order were legitimate, if it were actually doing what it said it was doing, it would do something different.
Right, and that sounds to me, Mr. Jarbrot, like you're saying that the factual accuracy of the stated reasons matters. Does the factual accuracy matter, and to what degree? I mean, if it is factually inaccurate, are you saying that undermines the legitimacy, or is it an intermediate a lesser defect, and how do we analyze it?
I think it would undermine the legitimacy of the order, or does undermine the legitimacy of the order, Your Honor, that it is factually inconsistent, internally factually inconsistent.
So you're saying that the president has to be correct in order for it to be facially legitimate?
I think that, at least facially
correct,
Your Honor.
Has to be factually correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
You're saying it's illegitimate because it's inconsistent, because it doesn't include other countries that also fit into this category? Is that what I understand your position?
And that some of the countries it does include are not actually.
Now, where do you get the information that there are other countries that should be in this?
If you look at the State Department report that's cited in the order.
No, I'm talking about the face. We're trying to stick with the order. And the order gives reasons for national security and makes observations about six countries that seem to pose a high risk of national security of the United States. Now, my question is, why isn't that a reason to support an order to delay for 90 days the issuance of visas until there can be an assessment as to whether the vetting's okay? Now, you say that's irrational and inconsistent?
I'm saying that the... Your Honor, I'm saying that the sources cited in the order itself do not actually support the conclusions that the order comes to.
How do you know that?
Because
you can't read the order to tell you that. I'm talking about you just don't want to answer the question as to whether this order on its face is legitimate. You come and say it should include other countries. You come and say that, some of the facts aren't accurate. I don't know where you get that from the face of the order.
But from what's cited and, I would argue, incorporated on the face of the order, Your Honor. But again, the question under Mandel, at a minimum, is whether it's facially legitimate and bona fide.
Do you agree that Mandel applies?
No, Your Honor. I actually think that Mandel is not the standard that the court needs to apply.
Position, that Mandel applies.
Yes, but I want to make very clear that we win under the Mandel standard, Your Honor.
Even if we adopt the Mandel standard, you think you win?
Absolutely.
Well, you think what's the standard? Lemon?
We think that the ordinary Establishment Clause cases apply, that there's no reason to extend Mandel to this context. There's obviously no rule that would instruct the court to apply Mandel in this.
Well, what applies?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Is it the Lemon test or the McCreary test? What do you call it?
The Lemon test is explained by McCreary, I think, would apply, Your Honor.
That's what I thought.
That's right. However,
but where even the Supreme Court made that application in immigration and foreign policy? I mean, those are domestic cases you're talking about. Fialo and Mandel specifically dealt with immigration.
But they didn't deal with the Establishment Clause. I mean,
First Amendment. It said the First Amendment, first of all, it made clear that the people beyond the borders do not have constitutional rights. It made clear that's a question of sovereignty as to who's admitted, and then it made clear that we're going to accept the Congress and the executive's application of orders so long as they are bona fide and reasonable, whatever the language of Mandel is. But they were directly facing the First Amendment, where, as you know, the Establishment Clause is also lodged.
Yes, Your Honor, but they weren't cases that involved a question about purpose. They weren't cases that involved a structural command like the Establishment
Clause. The court rejected a look to the purpose, except from the facial language of the order.
And Your Honor, I think that if there were any question about that, it's answered in Dinn, in Justice Kennedy's concurrence in Dinn, which is very clear.
You think we can read the current executive order and say that the order is so inherently inconsistent and so badly motivated that it was issued by the administration with the advice of the Secretary of State and Homeland Security and the Department of National Security in bad faith?
No, Your Honor. I think what this court should do is determine whether the order was issued in bad faith by looking to the evidence in the case. And the evidence in this case is not... It's far from the best piece of evidence in this case that the president said.
You're talking about the evidence of what the president said?
That's a big part of it,
Your Honor. But the government says we can't consider that.
And I don't understand why, because...
But that's where you all are like ships in the night. The government says it can't be considered what the president said during the campaign and what he said after the election and what he said since he's been president. And you say we have to consider that.
That's right, Your Honor.
That's the most important issue in the whole case.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
If we cannot consider what the president said during the campaign, do you lose?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Could you tell us why?
Yes, Your Honor.
I just thought this is surprising because earlier I asked you if a different candidate had won and issued the order, you said it would have been a legitimate order. So what makes it illegitimate are the statements of campaigner Trump about his intentions. Isn't that your argument?
I think there's three. No, Your Honor, and let me explain why.
There's at least part of the argument, isn't it? It's not.
Sorry. There's at least three categories of evidence to look to here. One is the order itself. Another is the statements of President Trump. And the third is other facts that are in the record that are not statements. And so one example of that would be what I've been faulted for mentioning several times, the fact that the intelligence agency in the Department of Homeland Security said that this order would not reduce terrorism in the United States. There's the fact, which is more recent,
National Security determination? Who makes the national security determination in this case?
Sorry?
Who makes the national security determination in this case? In other words, a determination that there's a risk that I'm addressing in the order. Who makes that determination?
I actually don't think that that's the determination that needs to be made Your Honor.
That's a question I'm asking you.
Yes.
I want you to answer it.
But I want to be clear that the question in this case is what is the purpose of the order, whether it's legitimate or not.
I did not ask you that.
Yes,
I said who makes the security determination in this case.
Ultimately, the court has to make all of the determinations that decide the case, Your Honor. And
you're having trouble saying that the President of the United States makes the national security determinations in the interest of national security?
The President of the United States, of course, makes
the answer to the question that Judge Shedd just asked you.
Okay.
Your problem with the question is that you can say who makes the national security determination. It's not about who was president, who was not president, or who made it. It's what happened in this particular case. That when you look at Mandel and you take it out of the facial part, when you consider Dinn, and the fact that that's a plurality opinion in which Justice Kennedy and Justice Alito made a concurrence, and in that concurrence they said, absent a showing of bad faith. So then the question then goes back to the question, is there bad faith? Not who's the candidate. Could have been any candidate. Any other candidates had done this same thing, we'd probably be right back here now. But what we have is, on his face, we do have those statements from the president on the campaign. We have statements after the campaign. We have statements after the Ninth Circuit opinion. And the question is that enough at this stage? We can get into this business of whether or not it's facially there and can he do it, but just seeing it alone and having what has already been established pretty much that it has the effect cannot be sufficient, though you could do anything in this country. And this is not the first time in history that this has been tried, but certainly the first time I know it's been done in this context.
That's right, Your Honor, and I do think that the implication of...
So my follow-up question was going to be, is it the president that makes the determination of national security issue interest in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. But
and your argument is he's tainted by animus, correct?
I'm saying that his purpose was a religious purpose, Your Honor.
Is that tainted by his animus, do you think?
Yes.
I mean, his harsh feeling toward Muslims. Do you think that taint goes to the Attorney General, to the Homeland Security Director, and to the Secretary of State?
No, Your Honor, but I think if you look at the history of what happened in this case...
Okay, then let me say, but doesn't the record in this case indicate that at least expressly the Attorney General and the Director of Homeland Security gave a basis for the order?
No, Your Honor.
They most certainly did.
Well, I think what this case shows, what the sequence of the first and second executive order shows, and the way that the second executive order was said to relate to the first executive order shows, is that the policy, the ban policy, which is at the center of this case.
The first question I asked you was, if there was animus or something, does it continue all the way through? If the Attorney General, I'm following up on that, if the Attorney General and the Director of Homeland Security, the Secretary, they say to the President that the current immigration policies place the country at a heightened risk of terrorist activities, and it is imperative that we have a temporary pause, and that temporary pause will immediately diminish the risk. Why doesn't that then, why would that, and you said they aren't tainted, why wouldn't that override any taint if you think there's a taint in the executive order?
Because, Your Honor, the question is, what was the purpose of this policy? The policy was decided on well before that letter was ever signed. That letter was actually signed the same day that the second policy was released. It couldn't even have been taken into account when they were developing the second policy.
You don't think maybe they talked? It's not in the record. You don't think people talk before they send the formal letter?
Well, but I mean, it's not in the record, Your Honor. There's no indication, and the Secretary of State...
And you think the implication of, I know the district court made some determination, it came the same day. The implication there is supposed to be that the president didn't know their thoughts before he got the letter? Is that what you would have us believe?
No, Your Honor. What I'd have you believe is what the facts show, which is that the policy was decided on well before that letter was signed, well before any consultation happened. It's clear.
What shows that that this is the case, if we take out all the campaign statements, let's just say we disagree with you on that. I'm trying to understand what you have as far as your case. If we excise his statements that you contend demonstrate animus prior to his taking the oath of office, what is your best case? Summarize it for us.
Sure. There's actually two lines, Your Honor. There's pre-election, post-election, and after...
Before taking the oath of office.
Before taking the... Okay, so after he took the oath of office, he said, when he was signing the executive order, said, we all know what that means, right? He also has continued to publish on his website his statement calling for a total and complete ban on Muslims entering the United States.
You're talking about his campaign website.
Yes,
not
Your Honor.
Not the White House website.
No, it's not on the web.
Right.
But it is his website. He does update it almost daily.
Can you remove things from the website? Help me out here.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Could he have removed it?
Of course. Of course he could have, Your Honor.
The government seemed to suggest, I thought, but I will be corrected on rebuttal, that, you know, once it's on there, it's on there. That's all there is to it.
No, Your Honor. Not only has he not removed that statement from the website, but of course he hasn't taken any other action to repudiate.
Still there today?
Yes. I haven't checked this morning, Your Honor.
Oh, was it there yesterday?
It was there last time I checked, which was in the last week or two.
We're going to look at the taint that this person who signed the order has, and we're going to look... Can we look at his college speeches? How about his speeches to businessmen about 20 years ago. Are we going to look at those two?
No, Your Honor, we're not giving you any of that sort of evidence in this case. What we're looking at here is statements specifically about
the kind of policy that he, in fact... I know, but I'm talking about he made those types of statements as a college student, perhaps. Perhaps he made it to a business club in New York during a speech 20 years ago. Perhaps he ran for office earlier and made similar statements. Are we going to look at all those, too?
Your Honor, those would obviously be much less probative than the statements he made over the last 2 years in the course of campaigning.
What you look for is things that are relevant and probative.
That's right, Your Honor.
So he says, I want to ban Muslims.
To figure out motive and intent.
And then he says, I want to ban Muslims. And then the next time he says, for clarification, I'm talking about the terrorists and I'm talking about the people who are from ISIS and Al-Qaeda. So which one are we going to use?
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, that's not what he said. What he said was that Islam hates us. What he said was that we have a problem with Muslims in the United States.
Did he ever mention Muslim extremists or terrorists or Al-Qaeda or ISIS?
Sure. But, Your Honor, what he said was, I'm going to ban Muslims, period. And then he said, I'm going to do it by talking territory, not Muslim, which is what he did, Your Honor. There's no question.
I'm sorry, I think I interrupted you when you were trying to answer Judge Keenan's question about what can we base it on post-January 20th, 2017? What's your best case?
Yes, Your Honor. So to start from the fact, again, that he has been publishing this statement, this call that not only calls for banning Muslims, but that makes statements about Muslims in general. The fact that he made that statement when he signed the order saying we all know what that means. And respectfully, Your Honor, we all know what that means. Doesn't suggest...
Can I ask you, what was he referring to when he said that?
He read the title.
To the order?
He read the title of the order, and then he said, we all know what that means.
And what's the title of the order?
Protecting the nation from... terrorist entry to the United States.
Foreign terrorist entry into the United States.
That's right. If it had actually meant that, then there'd be no need to say we all know what that means, Your Honor.
And then there's the fact that he
put this order into place without consulting the agencies that actually have expertise and knowledge in this area.
So he offended the bureaucracy? That's a constitutional crisis, that he didn't consult with the bureaucracy? Which I would suspect, maybe you don't believe it, I bet a lot of that bureaucracy willing to resist him on everything he wants to do. But the president's not required to talk to the bureaucracy before he acts, do you think?
No, Your Honor, but I think the fact that he did it is... relevant here. The fact that he did it is relevant to the question of whether his purpose was the stated one. Because
I want to talk to you for a second about public interest. The district court said this. The district court said there are heightened security risks with the designated countries, and it said it did not want to second guess the conclusion that national security interests would be served by the travel ban. But those statements, and by the way, this district judge, no fan of the order, obviously, he made those two statements. And then I didn't see that he dealt with what I asked you about, the statement from the Attorney General and the statement from the Homeland Security Director when they say there's a problem, it creates a risk, we need a pause, and that will diminish the risk. He didn't deal with that in his order. Shouldn't that be dealt with in what is in the public interest, whether you deny an injunction, although several people may be have their rights infringed upon, maybe, and they would have their be stressful about it for 90 days versus the high security risk and taking 90 days to protect it. Shouldn't that be considered in the conversation of wherein lies the public interest on the and the Winner case, by the way, suggests that in a case that public interest alone can justify denying an injunction.
Your Honor, I need to disagree with your characterization.
I thought you would.
With your characterization of the injuries suffered by the plaintiffs.
By the way, don't take that too much. I was just trying to encapsulate that. There is an injury.
It's
under the assertion, and it's a serious
and
injury.
Your Honor, it's an extraordinary injury.
But period of 90 days, in light of the fact, now I'm not saying that you have to agree with any of that. I'm just asking, did the district court even talk about that the way you and I are talking about it?
No, Your Honor. I mean, the district court found a constitutional violation.
They talk about public interest, though, in the way you and I are talking about it right now.
Well, and I first of all want to point out that the violation, the injury to the plaintiffs is severe. It is constitutional.
I'm giving you that. I'll just give you that for this argument, sure.
And I also want to point out that the government had the opportunity, not just in the district court, but in its stay application in this court, where it said it needed the extraordinary emergency relief of a stay pending appeal, to put in something, some piece of evidence
put in statements from the Attorney General, who I think you said is not tainted by animus, and they put in a statement, the same statement from the Secretary of Homeland Security, outlining just what I said. This is a serious problem. We need a stay. That's in the record.
With respect, Your Honor,
isn't that in the record?
The statements by this.
I said, is that in the record?
Yes, Your Honor, it's in the record. But the statements by that letter that's signed by the Attorney General and the Department of Homeland Security just echoes what's in the order. It doesn't actually provide any additional facts or evidence that would suggest that the public interest is actually being served
here. Well, here's the thing. Is the President, is the administration, the executive branch not entitled to some deference? As you know, we give it to functionaries, bureaucrats, whatever, under Chevron, we give them great, great deference.
Yes.
We give it to Congress. We presume that they've acted validly. We presume that. Are the secretary, cabinet-level folks in the administration not entitled to any deference on their conclusions?
But deference can't be a license to violate the Establishment Clause.
I didn't say it was. I said on the question of risk, can we rely on their assertions? On the question
Your Honor,
of how severe the risk is.
I don't read those letters as saying that there's a severe risk that would come from enjoining the order.
No, but it said the underlying current immigration policies place the country at a heightened risk of terrorist activities. It is imperative that we have a temporary pause that will immediately diminish. Some of that's paraphrasing, but that's what they said in the letter. There's a great risk. A temporary pause, great risk of terrorist activity, a temporary pause will diminish that. That's what they presented. Are they not entitled to any, those two aren't entitled to any deference?
They may be entitled to deference, Your Honor. Yes. I mean, there's a reason to defer to the judgment of officials who are close
and
to the fact.
Why wouldn't that be considered in the question of wherein lies the public interest on granting or denying the injunction? And why shouldn't that have been played out? It wasn't played out at all.
Well, I think because, Your Honor, the public interest does not lie in allowing a constitutional violation to consider.
But you have to talk
to continue,
about,
rather.
No, that's fine. I understand that's your view. But you have to talk about the interest on the other side and explore them. You just shouldn't say, I make this conclusion. The court is supposed to, at least on the injunction issue, weigh them and talk about them seriously.
Your Honor, I don't think there's enough on the other side here to weigh against the fact that the district court found a clear violation of the Establishment Clause. And I think that the approach to deference that would allow us to sweep aside all of the facts that show the President's bad faith purpose here to actually target a religion for condemnation, to denigrate its adherence.
How effectively does the order target Muslims? If he wants to ban all Muslims, what percent of Muslims are potentially affected by that ban?
It's a significant percentage of Muslims.
Less than 10% probably. Worldwide.
I don't have the number to hand, Your Honor, but more than 90% of the people banned by, well over 90% of the people banned by this order are Muslim.
No, but all that establishes that more than Muslims are affected by this order. But in the world, the number of Muslims is close to $2 billion, maybe a little shy of
well,
that.
Your Honor, I don't...
What if you just take my word for it, that the people affected by the ban, potentially affected less than 10% of all Muslims, do you think that is an effective effort by the president to ban all Muslims?
I think it is exactly what he said he was going to do, Your
Honor. Ban all Muslims?
Which was, he said he was going to ban Muslims, and he was going to do it by operating on territories.
When he said he wants to ban Muslims, do you think that, do you assert that was he wanted to ban all Muslims? I thought you'd said that.
That's what he said, Your Honor.
Counsel, under your theory of this case, how long does the taint last with respect to this administration?
I don't think there's a formula, Your Honor. I think that the question...
Well, at some point, if this case gets beyond us, the district court's going to have to come up with some kind of a test, right?
No, Your Honor. I think with respect to this order, the analysis set forth in McCreary shows that this order violates the Establishment Clause. I don't think
then what? What happens 60, 90 days down the road?
With respect to the Establishment Clause
with
violation?
With respect to this administration and its attempt to protect the nation from terrorism, if that is in fact their intent.
I think that if the administration wanted to take some other, and in fact the administration does things all the time, every day, to, you know, change immigration policy to affect national security in various ways.
What if they heighten the vetting in these six countries based on the investigation and require more information, more support for visas? Will that now be tainted because the president doesn't like Muslims?
No, Your Honor. I mean, I think that the question, Your Honor, would be, would the reasonable observer, looking at the specific set of...
I'm talking about this specific. I'm giving you a hypothetical. Stick with the hypothetical.
Yes, Your Honor.
The hypothetical is that after the investigation, they step up the vetting practices in these six countries, increase the information required in the investigation, that's the thoroughness of the investigation. Could those investigations, could the same people now challenge that increased scrutiny as violative of the Establishment Clause?
Right, Your Honor.
Based on the same evidence you have.
And I think that if it amounted to a ban, if the vetting was such a high...
It's not a ban. It's just increased standards. Stick with the hypothetical.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't mean to... what I'm saying is that it depends on how the vetting would operate in fact.
It doubles the scrutiny. It asks a lot more questions from people seeking visas from these six countries based on the investigation conducted.
Right.
Now, the question is, just as the order appears okay on its face, it's the motive behind it, the taint, that causes the problem for you. That taint, this is following up a little bit on Judge Diaz's question, that taint now would also have to go to the implementation of the order, right? In other words, what they do is they increase the scrutiny, and some citizens say, I don't like the increased scrutiny. It takes longer, and I have to spend more money and effort to get into the United States.
Right.
Violation of the Establishment Clause.
No, Your Honor. And that's not obviously anything like what the plaintiffs here are alleging.
What if the president repudiated his statements in campaign and post-election about the Muslim ban? What if he repudiated them all?
I think that would be significant, Your Honor. It would be a significant fact. I don't know whether...
Change the result at all? Does it change the result in your mind?
If the president...
He said, he asked if he repudiated it. Does that change the result?
I think a simple repudiation would not change the result.
Let me follow up then. What if he says he's sorry every day for a year? Would that do it for you?
No,
you
Your Honor.
Had that question earlier about...
Right, because
But his repudiation...
The question, Your Honor...
If this drove him to repudiation, and he said, I repudiate that, you would say, too bad.
Well, here's the issue, Your Honor, is that what the Establishment Clause prohibits is targeting and denigrating a religion, at a minimum. That's what it prohibits. And the question is, would reasonable people see what he was doing in total, as achieving that effect?
So you say reasonable people would say he doesn't really mean it when he says he's sorry.
Your Honor, I think it's possible that saying sorry is not enough. That's true in a lot of circumstances, Your Honor.
Let me ask you something that's not a hypothetical. Let me ask you about what the judge actually did here. He issued a nationwide ban on the Section 2C to impose this 90-day suspension. The rest of it, I take it, is still in place. That is, you can do all the studying. I know there's a Hawaiian order out there, too. If apparently there's a twofold purpose here. The 90 days is, as Judge Niemeyer has alluded to, it's because of national security. It's going to help the country. But 90 days is not forever. The real purpose has to go to the whole business. There's going to be a study, and we're going to look at it to see if they can get some rules. What's preventing the government from doing that, even as we're going now? Can the Hawaiian case do that, or can the government do that? Or is it, how do you prevent the president from conducting a study of all the other stuff that can be done outside of the 90 days? It seems to be consuming us about this 90-day ban, which is just 3 months. That's not a lot of time. The real issue has to go to something beyond 90 days, because we don't want a country just that's going to be safe for 90 days. We want a country that's going to be safe for years and years in the future. And so there's a whole business of reports and things being done, and I don't understand how the president can be prohibited from doing those ongoing things, whether it is to make sure that there are good travel bans or travel things from the other countries that are working out, even though this is this specific thing which is before us has been done. How is that possible?
Right, Your Honor. And obviously, to begin with, there's nothing in Judge Truong's order that would prevent in any way the government from proceeding with those studies.
Counsel, for the government to say they're under a court order not to do any of the studies or reports that
And I don't completely understand the government's position, Your Honor, because I understood the government to be saying that with respect to the six countries, they can't do studies, but with respect to other countries in the world, they can.
Six countries are the ones that the president and his team have found to present the highest national security risk.
Your Honor, all I'm saying is that I believe Section 2 of the order actually talks about a worldwide review of all vetting procedures across the country. So I just don't really understand how the government arrives at its conclusion.
To the whole business of we got what's before us is 90-day suspension.
Yes.
I mean, I know there's a nationwide ban from Hawaii. Maybe all there's an effect that can come from this or some other remedy. But before us is that. And if we simply say nothing wrong with that, you can still do it at least on our order. You can do all that other stuff. You can give reports. What prevents it? Does the Hawaiian court really do that? I don't understand that.
I think that's ultimately a question that's outside of my purview.
You understand it if the Hawaii order says you can't do it. You understand that much.
Yes, the Hawaii order.
Maybe going to jail in Hawaii is nice.
The Hawaii order doesn't enjoin the whole order.
Right, Your Honor. And there's obviously the other provisions
the
that talk about improving.
Of the order. There are several provisions of the order that are still, and the government's lawyer acknowledged that to me and said
right.
They have been indeed doing what they're supposed to do under those
right.
parts of the order.
And I think the question about the ongoing impact of the Hawaii order on the other studies will be probably clarified in the Hawaii litigation. But
I'll make sure I got this before we leave. Do you have any problem with the government conducting these studies?
No, Your Honor.
If they just took away this NIDA ban, everything else, they can study for, I suppose, all the things they want to do. Even if the Hawaiian court has a problem with it, you don't have any problem with it in terms of them doing everything else in this order. It's only the 90-day we're talking about.
Well, we have a problem with the ban in Section 6 as well, Your Honor. But with respect to the studies, no, we don't have any problem with the government proceeding with those studies. And I just want to point out that the government had all of the time under the first order that it had given itself to complete that study that was required in the first order. And they didn't do it, Your Honor. So the notion that all of this is really...
Those studies came forth with some compelling information, or at least maybe even a bona fide reasons. Your case would probably be less effective, at least from your perspective, don't you think?
I think that would change the analysis, Your Honor, if there were facts like that in the record. Obviously,
if those facts came forward, that washes out any taint?
At some point, Your Honor, then...
If those studies came forward with some information suggest this is a good idea to do this, then what Trump said or how he acted, that doesn't matter to you anymore?
No, Your Honor. Look, I think McCreary makes this clear, Your Honor. Those statements don't disappear in the analysis, but their significance changes, Your Honor. And if there is significance...
Would it change your position in this case? Would you say, we've got the studies, and they suggest this is a good idea, and therefore, what the president said in his campaign, whether we can use it or not, we want to make this clear. We don't want to use that anymore. There's no taint. The order is fine. You wouldn't say that.
Well, Justice Souter said something quite like that in McCreary. He said you could have something that's unconstitutional under one set of facts and have exactly the same action, but another set of facts, it would cease being constitutional.
I know it. I was asking him if he agrees with Justice Souter in this case.
Well, would I that think change that it? He doesn't know what the additional facts are.
I tried to tell him. He came forward with information that said this is a good idea. It makes sense. This type of approach makes sense from these studies.
And, Your Honor,
change your position.
I mean, to bring it back, my understanding is what the studies may or may not say is
you
that
know what
more
you have us doing? We're a court of the third branch, and you have the judiciary and all the various judges in this country supervising and assessing how the executive is carrying out his office in the national security and deciding when taints are faded, when taints are carried on, who they're carried on to, what evidence did the candidate say before, what evidence did the candidate say in college. I mean, don't we have some respect for the first branch and the second branch, like Mandel said? Okay. Said in the area of immigration, that is the greatest deference we owe to Congress and the executive.
Your Honor, of course, we're not asking you to superintend every decision.
It sounds like it. You're talking about, in this factual circumstance, the taint fades. If he says sorry with sincerity, maybe it goes away. If he says sorry without sincerity, no, we're not going to do it.
Because the nature, Your Honor, of any factual inquiry into purpose, which is both what Mandel requires and what McCreary requires, the nature of any factual inquiry into purpose is going to turn on the facts before the court. And that is a decision that
except
as
Mandel excluded purpose. Mandel said you look facially, and in this case, looking facially at the order says in the interest of national security, based on the fact that these six countries sponsor terrorism, provide havens for terrorism. We don't even have consulate operations in some of the countries. In these countries, because of the higher risk, we want 90 days to study the issue.
Your Honor, respectfully.
Now, that on its face, you're saying, establishes religion.
Respectfully, the approach you're taking reads out the bona fide prong of Mandel and discards Justice Kennedy's controlling concurrence in Dinn. And it's just not consistent with the law. And it would lead to the point that the government wants to leave you at, which is that the president could say tomorrow, I dislike Jews. I don't want them in the country. I'm going to issue an executive order banning Israelis from the United States
If you're right about the order in this case, then I just don't know where it stops, because hereafter,
Your Honor,
if we all of a sudden increase the vetting in some of these countries where they sponsor terrorism, the argument is going to be the same one. A wife who wants to come to this country and who's delayed will say, this was because I'm Muslim, not because of the national security. And we're going to have the same debate. We're going to second question the face of the order or the face of the practice. I don't know where it ends. It seems to me we have to function in our three branches and give some respect to each branch.
Your Honor, I think the question is not so much where it ends, but if it starts at all, and if the court will do its constitutional duty of making sure that the Establishment Clause is real, that the president is not allowed to violate it simply by invoking a national security reason, no matter how thin or pretextual it might appear to be on the facts. And that is what is happening here, Your Honor. You don't have to address the question.
And the remedy would be that we would have a different take on immigration policies because this isn't acceptable. Is that it? And who would decide what that is?
I'm sorry, we would have a different...
Who would decide what immigration policy is?
The president would decide on what immigration policy is, and Congress.
Well, the president just tried to decide it. He tried to decide it with the 90-day ban. He thought that was in the interest of the country, at least part of it. You don't allow, you say there's more to it. If the president hadn't taken, if the president's faced with a national security risk, and he takes us, and he doesn't take any steps to avoid it, and then somebody who comes through that light vetting or whatever you want to call it, comes here and creates a disaster, takes American lives, it's on the president. If the president tries, and he stopped this way, and something happens, some person falls through that no longer allowed pause or the vetting from countries where there's just total chaos, and something happened, who's responsible for that? Who's responsible for that?
Your Honor, the person who does it is responsible for the act.
No, I'm talking about as far as setting policy.
The president is not allowed to set a policy that violates the Establishment Clause.
I got that.
So it's not this court's fault for invalidating.
So it still falls back on the president. Although he said there's a risk. The Attorney General says there's a risk. I'm trying to do something about it. Because of a taint that we would read into it to get to the motivation, we'd say that can't be done. So the president, I started by asking, then can the president do anything just to pause things for 90 days? And if he can't do that, if something happens in that time period, who's responsible?
Well, Your Honor, it's obviously been more than 90 days.
Doing the 90-day period or doing the period until we resolve it, who's responsible? When the American people say, who's responsible? In the first part, they would look at the president and go, you didn't do what you should have done to take care of us. And he would go, I tried to. So who's responsible?
Your Honor, I think this is actually
a good place to end.
Far from perhaps a good place to end.
It's also a good place to consider, if we follow that line of reason, how would we think differently of Korematsu now? We follow that reason. If you don't lock them all up and something bad happens, then it's on the president. If you do, you violate law. If we follow that, does that follow in every other thing we do?
I think it means that we always have to defer whenever the president says he's doing it for a safety reason.
You were about to say a hypothetical regarding the admission of Jews into this country and some notion that the president would be able to bar that. What would be the rationale for that?
If the president said, on the government's theory, As I understand the government's theory, it's the theory it wants you to adopt rather than the theory its second best argument. The government says that the government would agree that as long as, if the president said, I want to bar Jews because I think Judaism is an evil religion, let's say, and then he issued an order the next day that said, Israelis are not allowed into the United States. I note that terrorist attacks have taken place in Israel and that terrorists have infiltrated the state of Israel on occasion. Full stop. That would be facially legitimate and bona fide. That order would be facially legitimate and bona fide on the government's reading because they read out the bona fide prong and because they say that facially legitimate can have no actual searching analysis behind it.
Well, but the face of this order has much more than that, right? Sort of the individual justifications for each of the countries is set out.
Well, this is one country and one justification. It's actually not very different. There's one paragraph for each country, three lines maybe, in this order. And they say essentially the same thing. There are terrorists in this country. There's problems in this country. That's enough on the government's theory.
Actually, in fact, it was the predecessor administration that had made that determination. Isn't that right?
No, Your Honor. The predecessor administration made the determination that vetting dual nationals who would otherwise be able to get in without visas, putting them through the visa process, was sufficient to address any national security concerns about dual nationals.
National security concerns. So this is not something of this current administration's imagination. There was some basis to initiate the process to begin with.
Your Honor, I don't think that the determination made by the previous administration about these countries resembles at all the determination made here. It's true that they both touch on or they both address the same list of countries, but they're different determinations. And they can't...
Well, different results, but not different reasons. In other words, the previous administration found a risk in these seven countries, as does this administration. So at that point, the fact that there is a heightened risk is legitimate and is bona fide, at least under your standing, because you're saying if somebody else issued this order, it would be all right.
Your Honor, to come back to the hypothetical I was trying to play out, if there was, they could point to probably some determination made by a previous administration that, in fact, terrorist attacks had happened in Israel and that terrorists had infiltrated the country. There's a whole list of countries in that State Department report, again, many of which are non-Muslim countries, that have some history of terrorism, some concern about them being safe havens. In the government's view, they didn't even have to do that. All they had to say was, I'm doing this for national security reasons, and I have good national security reasons. And that's it. Notwithstanding, and without regard to how clear the evidence of animus was, how direct the effort to denigrate a religion might have been. And that really would essentially say that, as far as the president goes, the Establishment Clause has no meaning.
Thank you, Mr. Janowak.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Wall, you have time reserved?
If you want to take it.
Mr. Wall, you want to start out with the hypothetical that your opponent spun out? Is he right?
No, I think if the president came in and had a law that was neutral on its face and in operation that didn't operate on the basis of religion, no, I don't think he's right. If the president came in and operated on the basis of religion, did it explicitly or through a Lukumi-like gerrymander?
Well, the president has an animus toward Jews, and he's indicated that publicly. But apparently on the face of this order that he has spun out, there's also some facial justification we're excluding Jews from this country. Does that present a violation?
If the president puts forward a rationale not connected to religion and that rationale is supported by the order and sufficient to survive Mandel, no. If the president doesn't, then it would fail.
So it doesn't matter what the president says, essentially. You're saying it only matters what the president does in his official capacity.
Well, I don't want to press this too far, Judge Keenan, because the qualifier at the end is very important. We can imagine that the president would say or do things in an official capacity, not on the campaign trail, but after he takes the oath and he comes into office, we could imagine he would say or do things that would bear on the order. Here we have one six-word remark as he's signing the statement looking at the title. And so I think the court doesn't really need to press at that line here. Just three very brief things.
You do have to press there because you say, as you read Mandel, we can't look behind it whether he says it or she says it as president or not.
I think that once you've established that it survives rational basis review, that's right. Mandel says you don't look behind it, except that, as Judge Wynn says, there is
the
a suggestion.
What you urge us to say is that if on its face, it's legitimate. And you read out bona fide, it means something. It's the same thing.
Bona fide same way rational review works, and this court said it in the Johnson v. Whitehead case, looking at a statute that was alleged to accord preference for visas on the basis of sex and illegitimacy. And the court said, we look at the facial legitimacy of the executive branch's rationale, and then we look at whether that rationale bears a reasonable relationship to the conduct. That's the bona fide part. And if it survives that, we don't inquire behind into subjective motivations. That's Mandel. We're not going to ask whether the attorney general kept him out if he's a communist, because a reasonable attorney general, giving the reason here, could have kept Mandel out. Judge Agee, I promised you an answer to your
question. Before we leave Mandel, can I just ask one last question on this? So you've talked a lot about Mandel, but there's that other line of cases, Zavidas, Chadha. I don't think Zavidas is in your brief, but I think Chadha is, where the court says, look, plenary power over immigration, absolutely, but it must be exercised in a way consistent with the Constitution. All right, so we do have to apply the Constitution. And if the constitutional norm, the Establishment Clause, if constitutional doctrine imposes a purpose test, it seems like now we're a little bit at cross purposes. We have one set of cases saying you have to apply the Constitution, even in the immigration context. And then we have your reading of Mandel, which says we may not look at purpose, but the constitutional rule is you can't act with an impermissible purpose. It seems to me all of this is resolved very elegantly by the bona fide qualification in Mandel. When the constitutional rule that we are told to apply by cases like Zavidas and Chadha involves a purpose inquiry, good news, Mandel allows for a purpose inquiry under the bona fide formulation as construed in the controlling concurrence in Din. What's wrong with my elegant solution?
Judge Harris, it's always a question of what the Constitution requires. Mandel has always been thought to apply to constitutional challenges to the denial of entry of aliens at the border who themselves have no constitutional rights. In cases like Zavidas that deal with deportation or aliens here who do have some rights under statutes or the Constitution, what the substantive standard is can change, and we no longer think it's just Mandel. It can be something more. So it's always a question. We're not saying the Constitution doesn't apply. We're saying it applies under Mandel in that because the president is operating at the height of his powers, this is Youngstown 1, it doesn't get anything more than rational basis.
It's not about dividing up the power between the president and Congress. I thought the through line in Youngstown is, look, if neither the president nor Congress can do it because of some negative part of the Constitution, like the First Amendment, it's not a Youngstown question at all anymore. I don't understand what it means to say that we're at, no one's arguing about whether this is Congress versus the president. Why is Youngstown wrong?
No, it's saying that where the president is acting at the borders to protect our nation's security, because he's operating at the height of his power, both constitutional and statutory, what the Constitution requires is lower than what it requires in other contexts. It requires, as Mandel says, facial legitimacy and a bona fide reason. But the court goes on to say, but you don't look behind. So it can't have meant by that when you inquire into subjective motivation, because then Justice Marshall would have been right. You look at why the AG kept him out. What it had to mean by that is what this court has said. It's rational basis review. And when counsel says, look, other presidents could have done this, I think he's conceding that it survives rational basis review. Reasonable government actors could have done this. And then we're all down to the statements, and it's all a question of the statements. And even if you disagree with all of our arguments why, as a matter of law, you can't consider them, they're just not enough here to overcome a formal national security judgment of the president.
You were about to answer my earlier question.
I was, Judge Agee. So the three John Does, or John Doe 1, John Doe 3, and Jane Doe 2, are seeking immigrant visas. Paul Harrison, who was the fourth, was seeking a non-immigrant K-1 visa. But only John Doe 1 still has a live claim. Obviously, we've said he doesn't have Article 3 standing and he doesn't have prudential standing under cases like Valley Forge. But
last, the individual seeking the non-immigrant visa, was that one of the four the district court found had standing?
Well, the district court didn't rely on the fourth, who was Paul Harrison, because as we told the district court at the hearing, Paul Harrison's spouse had received his K-1 visa. So the district court didn't rely on Paul Harrison. He relied on the three does, but one doe, it'll be years before her sister could come in no matter what happens. So I don't take the plaintiffs to be relying on her. And John Doe 3's wife has now gotten a visa, and we've said she can travel. I think only John Doe 1 has a live claim. And even if you disagree with us that John Doe 1 has standing, I think the court's got to narrow the injunction to the alleged injuries of John Doe 1. You have a global injunction resting on one plaintiff. And this court was clear in the Virginia Human Society for Human Life case that where you have a plaintiff, no matter what the nature of their constitutional claim, if you find that claim is likely to succeed on the merits, they still only get an injunction to address their injuries. And here that would be John Doe 1 and his wife. It's not an injury that extends to everybody else in the country and everybody else at the borders.
Okay. So Mr. Waldo, let me ask you about this numerical sweep, because that's what's one of the things that's bothering me a little bit. And my math wasn't right when I gave you a number. It really is about 200 million people who are caught in this net when you add up the population of these six countries. And we have a few examples cited of terrorist activity in the executive order, but not attributed to the nationals, not attributed to any of these 200 million people. Does that affect the facial legitimacy of the order when it has such an enormous sweep of 200 million people and just isolated examples that don't involve these 200 million?
No, so I don't think I was very clear on this earlier. So if you look at sections 1D through F of the order, what it's focused on are the governments of these countries, and what the president says in these full two pages, single-spaced, is these countries' governments are not, I'm sure, he says, I'm not sure they're providing us with reliable information, and so I'm not sure I can screen out the nationals who may want to do us harm, and that's why I want to put in place the temporary pause. So it's not focused on the nationals so much, Judge Keenan, as it is the governments of these countries and our relationship with them and whether we're getting reliable information in order to be able to screen their nationals. And I think if you focus on those sections, that's really the basis for the order, and I think it's clearly enough to trigger the president's determination under 1182F. And at that point, all they're left with is their constitutional claim. And they're really down to the statements. And that's what it all boils down to. And I think for all the reasons I've given, they shouldn't prevail on that. But even if they did, we'd be looking at a narrow injunction tailored to these plaintiffs who have cognizable irreparable injury. And that's not what this injunction is. And the last thing, if I could just say this, Chief Judge Gregory, I mean, look, the order before this court has been the subject of heated and passionate political debate, to be sure. But the precedent set by this case for this court's role and the judiciary's role in reviewing the president's power at the borders to keep our nation safe will long transcend this debate and this order and this constitutional moment. And in cases like this one that spark such intense feelings on both sides, we would respectfully submit it is all the more important to apply the usual rules of justiciability and interpretation and injunctive relief. And applying those rules here, we respectfully submit that that debate ought to be left where it belongs in the political arena, and this injunction should be vacated. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wall. Thank you, counsel. I'm going to ask the clerk to adjourn the court for today. We'll come down to Greek counsel.
Please rise and remain standing. This honorable court stands adjourned until tomorrow morning. God save the United States and this honorable court.